Voices of VR Podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR Podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my series of looking at different projects from Venice Immersive 2024, today's episode is with a piece that was part of the College Biennale called Earths to Come. So Rose Bond is somebody who's from the animation world, but did this really interesting collaboration with Roomful of Teeth and this other composer that they put together this piece where it was inspired by this Emily Dickinson poem and some of the different experiences that people were having within the context of the pandemic, and then able to create this really poetic translation that was exploring these contrasts of vastness and isolation and loneliness and other feelings that were inspired from this poem, but also the experiences of the pandemic. But it was in the geodesic dome where there were 12 different seats and people would go in and put on a VR headset and look forward and then have like a 16-channel vector-based audio that was coming in that was really just a sound field that just sounded amazing. Really quite compelling piece, especially when it comes to spatial audio. And also just this blending and blurring between the spatial audio and this kind of more poetic visual abstractions that were coming from Rose Bond and some of the other different types of hand-drawn animation that she's done in the past. So really quite an interesting project and really enjoyed it as well. And also really enjoyed learning a little bit more about how it all came about. So that's what we're coming on today's episode of the Voices of VR Podcast. So this interview with Rose happened on Saturday, August 31st, 2024. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
My name is Rose Bond, and what do I do in VR? Well, I'm the new girl. Until 6 months ago, I'd never made a VR. I became interested in VR probably about 3 years ago because I live in Portland, Oregon, and Pam Cutt or Amy Dodson brought the best of the Venice Biennale VR to Portland. And I was involved with Pam Cutt and the Cinema Unbound Awards, and through that I met Michelle and just kind of became curious. I think the first VR that I saw that I really was moved by was Nothing Happens by the Kranichs. And I think I saw Brian's story and, I began to think, there's something here. It's not just games. And so my work has always been or has been installation-based projections since about the year 2000. So I'm used to working outside the traditional rectangle.
Yeah, and maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and how you're kind of weaving all of your disciplines and previous practices into what you're doing now in the immersive space.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a drawer and a painter, a poor painter, but a pretty good drawer. And I learned animation in Portland again, which was a scene for a lot of independent work. And people were making animation in really bizarre sort of material kinds of ways, not cell animation. Portland is not LA. And so it allowed a lot of freedom. So my first films were made by drawing directly on clear leader. So it's really up close in the frame, or in the frames per second kind of world. And I made about five films by drawing on film. I became pretty tired of that small space. And the mid-90s, the digital revolution was happening. So Adobe was, it's like Photoshop. And I learned After Effects. And I began to see, I could really break out of this. I could bring in drawings, I could bring in photos, I could do all this stuff. And not only that, I didn't have to stay in a 1920 or a 720 kind of rectangular format. I could really expand out. So I came into installations most recently, like I'm saying, in the last 5 years or so, maybe more than that, 7 years, I've been working with live music in the Oregon Symphony and acting more like a VJ in terms of controlling multiple screens in coordination or conjunction with music.
Yeah, and so it sounds like being in Portland, there's the Portland Art Museum and now the Portland Art Museum Center for Untold Tomorrows, the PAMCUT, and, you know, bringing in the Venice Biennale during the pandemic. And it sounds like that the pandemic was kind of a key inspiration for Earth to Come, of like doing art to kind of deal with the different experiences of isolation or loneliness. Maybe you could just sort of set the context for what was the origins for you for Earth to Come?
The origins for Earth to Come. Yeah, I think it does. It totally ties into the pandemic. March 14th was scheduled, 2020, was scheduled for the opening of a piece, a huge piece that I was doing with the Oregon Symphony called Luciano Berio's Sinfonia. And the group that was singing that, or not singing, but vocalizing it, was Roomful of Teeth. 2 days before we were to open, we were all set up, we'd rehearsed. I had, you know, like 6 20K projectors, and we're going to project on the walls of the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The governor shut down all big events. So we were left, like most people that do performing art kinds of things, with really nothing much to do for a couple of years. So when we were emerging from COVID, one of those times, Roomful of Teeth contacted me and said, "Hey, Rose, we've got an idea. We have a composer, an emerging composer, and who wants to work with us, and we want to do a piece with visuals, and we want you to do the visuals." So that composer was Inti Figgis Vizueta. Teeth, that's what I call them affectionately. Teeth brought us together at Mass MoCA. They do a residency there, and Inti and I got an afternoon together with Teeth to kind of sort of try out the car in some ways, like, and see how it would run, and also for us to see how we got along and what in this, you know, vast array of artistic freedom, what was the thing that we could come together on that would hold our interest and be close to the kind of feeling that we have for work to make it be good. So Inti suggested a poem by Emily Dickinson, and that poem is "I Have No Life But This." There's a line in that poem, it's only 8 lines, very simple, that has to do with Earth's to come, and that became the title for the piece. So again, I think Dickinson sort of reflects a lot of the emotions that I think I felt, or a lot of people felt during COVID, is isolation, the horror, and desire to be with someone, desire to see people you love, to be close. And yeah, that doesn't always work out. So, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that at the end of your performance, you handed out the Emily Dickinson poem, and I tracked down the actual poem. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read through the poem.
Okay, yeah, so theatrical reading. Okay, "I have no life but this, to lead it here, nor any death, but less dispelled from there, nor tie to earth to come, nor action new, except through this extent, the realm of you."
Nice. And I know in the video that you had for Venice Immersive that you were talking around the contrasts and the dialectics that you see in the poem. Maybe you could elaborate on the different tensions that you see inherent to the different dialectics in there.
Yeah, I think the poem speaks to, and I think the work speaks to, this idea of vastness and intimacy. And I think playing with that sort of vastness, which I think a lot of us kind of in a Star Wars kind of way or whatever, associate the universe with that starfield and the Challenger going, or whatever, going into it. I like to play with some of the sort of the ingrained images that we all have, and somehow do something that puts something unexpected in it, sort of disrupt the train. And so this piece sort of does that in a way, I think, that is, it's hardly in your face, but it still is questioning our notions of what is vast, our notions of what's beautiful, and looking at, I think, the world in a way of darkness and light, that I don't want to make a big binary thing out of this, but it really is, I think, important. Humor and sadness, you know, life is not just simple. It isn't all happy endings, but it's this complexity that allows us to feel, I think, a full gamut. And this is only a 12-minute piece, but I think what we were trying to do is evoke a range to have people finish with it and have been totally present just for 12 minutes. We're not asking you to do anything. You don't have to collect anything. You don't have to use the hands. So, you know, it's a really simple use, I think, of VR.
Yeah, and so it sounds like the poem was a key inspiration that's also feeding into your visuals of the piece, but also the composition that was composed for Room Full of Teeth. And so what was the process like for you to iterate back and forth between getting the music or having, like, were the visuals impacting the music and vice versa? And, like, what was the process of starting with the poem and then from where did you go from there to start to tie everything together?
Yeah. So, you know, composers, I think of composers as, you know, just sitting down writing sheets of music and kind of every note is there and there's like, you know, do this and do this high, do this, you know, whatever, flats and all that kind of stuff. That is not the way that Inti Figgis-Vizuete works. She makes something called a one sheet. So if I could just give you a picture. Let's say you have that, you know, all those lines, and sorry, I don't even know music terms, but you have eight notes. So Inti will have those eight notes, and the singers will all be there, and she'll say, this is a like a melody. Let's try this for a minute. Eight notes. And then she'll say, and then see the bottom of the page there, there's some words. Just feel free to insert those words whenever you think it's a good moment. And kind of like some notes of this, just sort of a general feel or a general texture. And then the vocal band, Room Full of Teeth, will sort of riff on that. And there's eight singers, they're in an arc, they look at each other. Each one is mic'd, they're mixing on the fly by pulling away from the mic or not. So it's just like this really organic way of working. So as an animator who takes hours and weeks and whatever to make stuff, it was a little nail-biting at times for me to work with such an improvisational kind of thing. So it took several kind of residencies for us to get, I'd say, a musical sketch. I just told Inti, I said, just give me something that has the feel and texture. And we had, you know, talks, so we'd become to, you know, get a vocabulary that we can share from me from the visual world and Inti from this classical music, new music world. And so I guess, yeah, and that vocabulary includes everything from John Wick to, you know, Emily Dickinson to, you know, I don't know, just a lot of different things to make that relationship.
Yeah, well, I know for animation, a lot of times they'll record the audio tracks and then have everything recorded, and then you animate to that audio. Was that the case here, where you're kind of waiting for them to lock down what, even though it's got this improvisational character of how it was being constructed, did they kind of lock it in and then hand it over to you to do the visuals, or were you kind of also creating visuals and then showing them something and then maybe changing or modulating what they were doing to kind of fit more with the visual aesthetic that you were going for?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, because it was definitely in person with me with visuals that I had brought. Let me just back up a minute. So I got a grant through the Princess Grace Foundation for a work in progress residency at the Baryshnikov Art Center in New York. And that allowed me to bring my programmer Steve and Zach, my composite guy, to New York, and we spent 2 days setting up three screens suspended in the Jerome Robbins Theater. Room Full of Teeth arrived on Wednesday, and we began to rehearse. Inti was there Tuesday and Wednesday, and we started recording. But I was playing the role of the VJ, so I had prepared clips, and they were looking at the projections either above them or at a monitor at their feet. And so it became a thing where we realize, oh, I have to take a cue from the singers, or they have to take a cue from the visuals. So it was figuring out that. And then once we got a recording, yeah, we could lock it down, but we couldn't have done it without that back and forth. Like, I don't want them as my soundtrack, and I don't want to be their visual wallpaper.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay, so it was more of a jazz, like, rather than typical sit down and animate every frame, you're kind of doing more of a live VJ type of improv that you're going back and forth, but there's a feedback loops until you've finally locked down the audio, and then it sort of turns into a question of translating those visuals that were in a three-screen, multi-screen projection with three screens into more of like a immersive VR spatial video that's fully immersive that you can then have people looking mostly forward. So it's mostly like a 180 video because you want to have people not looking around, because so much of this experience is in its final presentation here at Venice Immersive is with these like 16 channels of audio that are coming through, and that, you know, it's actually a little bit better experience to just kind of keep your head locked looking forward to then listen to the sound fields that are flooding you with the sound of this, you know, beautiful soundtrack that the Roomful of Teeth had put together for this piece. So yeah, it sounds like maybe you could just kind of elaborate of once you did get it like locked down, then you enter into the next phase of taking it from what was a 2D multi-screen performance now into more of a fully immersive one.
Right, yeah. And that was, like I say, 6 months ago, I'd never made a VR. And it was only going through the Venice Biennale Cinema College that I met tutors and began to see, and colleagues, and began to see, you know, a path ahead to be able to take those three screens and put them into a VR situation. But in 6 months, it was like, I'm not going to learn Unreal Engine. You know, we didn't learn Unity. We used After Effects and Cinema 4D, which are fine, lovely programs, but they don't have what's called a live play or live view, whatever. That means that it's kind of like old school, where you have to render overnight to see if what you did is actually going to have that feeling in a headset. Because what I realized, and which I suspected is true, is as a filmmaker, I'm very good on that XY, and there's kind of a little fake Z axis that you can do with perspective and whatnot. But in VR, you really have this sense of space. And I'll say, like, everyone knows that feeling when someone comes up and stands too close to you. Like, you can really get in people's space, or you can put something too high, and it looks like, you know, sort of, I told Zach, it looks like I'm looking up at Daddy right now. It's like, we got to bring that down. We got to learn how to talk to each other in these kind of degrees that have to do with, had to do with depth. I'm not sure if I'm explaining that right, but it is something. It's like a haptic sense that you get from VR, and a lot of people, you know, get sick and all that stuff, but you can do so much more with it. It is like, how close do these letters or do these objects come to you, you know, or brush by you, or that bird, you know, how far away is it, you know? And it's like all those things that animalistically I think we respond to, you have this power as an artist to kind of engage that.
Yeah, and it seems like that the going back to the Emily Dickinson poem, because you had found a copy of this poem in the phrase of Earth's to Come, the title of the piece comes from that, but you were able to mimic her handwriting and then translate some of that as kind of a visual motif that is repeated throughout the course of this piece as well. And so maybe you could talk about constructing the visuals and using these different elements, like these words and other. It's a very poetic piece, so it's actually kind of difficult for me to remember all the different beats, because it kind of flows from one scene to the next, and there's a lot of poetry in there, and I think it kind of, I was taking more away the feeling than kind of remembering all the specifics from what happened from moment to moment. But yeah, just this kind of like more solemn, contemplative, reflective experience, but also the sound. I was also remembering just the amazing sound field that we'll get into. But in terms of the development of the visuals, what was your process to bring in these different elements to create the look and feel of it?
Well, again, you know, you're at this situation where, you know, you decide, yeah, let's use this poem, you know, and it's sort of like, I'm not going to illustrate that, you know. So how do you get at these feelings that you suspect might be underneath them or that are underneath you, you know? Like, what do I have to say about all this in some kind of metaphoric way? And again, trying to, looking at the Dickinson poem, it's 8 lines. It's almost like a child's nursery rhyme in some ways. It's just so simple and yet so profound. I encourage people to just check it out, Google it. I have no life but this. Yeah, it was running in. I didn't know that Emily Dickinson had an archive at Amherst or that, you know, I didn't really know. I sort of maybe knew that maybe her house was there or all that kind of stuff. So I found the online, I found that archive. She wrote rough drafts of her poetry and she used scraps of envelopes and letters and a pencil. And she would pencil and cross out. And she's got this funny way of, it's like how she forms her letters. It's not cursive. It's individual letters, and the way that they're spaced is odd. But I looked at that. They're just so graphically interesting. And I've been really interested in pencil lately. I did the whole Berio piece in pencil, Blackwing pencil. And so I thought, a pencil, yeah. So it became, you know, one of maybe 6 motifs that are kind of choreographed throughout Earth to Come. Yeah. But those letters, they're so beautifully roundy formed, not in a contemporary way that we make a D or anything. But they could tumble or they could float. So the letters became objects. And I think that that's the same with the sound. Roomful of Teeth makes noise. They make beautiful harmonies. They make textured percussive sounds. So it's like a language in a way becomes objectified. It carries meaning way more than the words. It's gestural, yeah, expressive. I don't know. Have a listen.
Yeah, you mentioned one of the motifs of the Emily Dickinson poetry and the letters, and my recollection was that there's kind of like the sun-like imagery, or at least like big vastness of yellow to give you the sense of like the bigness of the sun versus the smallness of the earth. But maybe you could just describe some of the other motifs that you're exploring in this piece.
Yeah. I want to talk about the dark section, okay? There's a lot of stuff that's kind of like looking up at stars at night. If you go backpacking or something, you get to see a lot of stars. You get to see a lot of stars at the beginning of this piece. It's beautiful and, got this sort of endless depth to it. And then there's this kind of sort of lyrical, like leaves falling with scraps of rough draft that are kind of in this, like this vacuum of space, but somehow there's a little breeze. So those are some of the things. But there had to be like some kind of contrast, like life isn't always breezy. So I call it like the cave or the dark basement. And it opens with a percussive section by Roomful of Teeth, lots of pops and clips and that kind of thing. And using kind of a Len Lai, kind of particles in space motif with those little curling animations, abstracted pops and gestures. That's what sort of opens it. And then you find yourself in this dark, like, am I in underground? Am I in these tangled roots? And then it kind of opens where you see these, like, glimpses. Well, really, I took my inspiration from German Expressionism and those kind of angled shadows that could be structural from something, but you're not sure what. So that whole thing of you're not sure what. You're not sure what that happens in the dark, in the shadows. And you emerge from that, I think, in a really gorgeous way with the sound into this drawing of Emily Dickinson's entry hall and a stairway. So, yeah.
I love listening to you talk about your experience because, you know, it is such a poetic, visual heavy, but also sound driven piece that, you know, there's a lot of abstractions that are happening that feel a little bit more metaphorical than, like, sometimes it's difficult to kind of like trace a narrative or trace a through line or even have me kind of describe what you just said and have the same type of language because it's like I'm sort of taking it in for the first time. So yeah, it feels like sometimes when I see pieces, it feels like a center of gravity of like just putting into my heart and like more of a feeling space than a word space. And I think this is a type of piece that tries to get at that just because the music is also so strong of like trying to evoke those emotions. I feel like the music is trying to, in the quadrivium, they would say like there's numbers, which is just numbers and time, which is like music, and then numbers and space, which is geometry, and then numbers and space and time, which is more astronomy. So it feels like numbers and time is like this music, and there's something around that music that just is driving emotion and evoking so much emotion. And so I feel like there's so much around this piece with the Room Full of Teeth composition that just puts me into a feeling space, and like the visuals are kind of giving me an excuse to not put too much language to it, but to still remain into that like more feeling space than mind space.
I don't know what to add to that. That's and you know, yes, it's all in between the lines. I think that's so much with poetry too. Why did that line? Why did you end there when there's not a period? Why did you know, and sort of this, I don't know, alchemy that happens when we let ourselves be there with that kind of art, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, and in the final presentation here, it's in a big, like, 6-meter dome with, like, these 16 main channels with the subwoofer. And I was talking to the sound person afterwards, and he said, I asked him, I was like, is this ambisonic mix? And he's like, no, because ambisonics only really work if you were, like, in the middle of the dome, then ambisonics would make sense. But because you have 12 people in the dome, then they need to do, like, some sort of vector-based audio. But there's, like, the way that the speakers are there, it feels like I'm still being surrounded in a sound field that feels much more high fidelity and rich than what I normally see in a more of a binaural mix muxed down to just two headphones that I'm wearing on a headset. But to be completely surrounded by the sound, I think, was a very immersive and visceral experience. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the process of, like, designing that spatial sound experience.
Well, for one thing, yeah, Room Full of Teeth, when they perform, they're amplified. So each person has a mic, and they are sort of self-mixing on the fly by backing away and whatever. And like I say, they're very improvisational in how they make their music. So we had a recording with 8 tracks and then a mic for the room. And Maximiliano Borghese, who we met through the college, is a spatial sound designer. And so he took what we had. We decided on this geodesic dome. So you think of Buckminster Fuller, you know, it's like, it's just kind of these steel things. It's sort of raw, but it's really pretty. And, you know, some lights and stuff. But it feels, again, it creates a kind of communal space that we wanted. So right now in Venice, we've got like 12 chairs in there, 12 kind of white pod chairs. And Kent's right. It's like I thought that with this, I hadn't heard the spatial mix until I got here like a week and a half ago. And sitting in there into the dome, it's like in the middle chair, I thought that would be the sweet spot. But I sat in other chairs around the space, and the piece became a little bit different because I was closer to different voices. But still, every seat felt full. So it's, it's extraordinary. And I think we're going to have more of this because it is, it's a democratic kind of way of experiencing this. I think you used the word high fidelity. High fidelity experience, but also more like you're really there, like you'd be in a conversation, but you're overhearing something else. But it's hard to explain. It's just so damn satisfying. Yeah.
Well, normally when someone's performing, if they're standing in front of you, you basically hear them in a straight line, or maybe they're in the arc, but it's a lot different if they would be like hanging over a dome and singing on top of you. And so like having the sound come in from all these different angles of like 16 different angles, and it's all colliding in. And as I turn my head, I can hear like, you know, there's a lot of like HRTF and ambisonics and other just like head-based rotation audio that's like, it's all like this layer of having to go through this processing and being synthesized, and there's something lost with the organic nature of like they're trying to recreate something with that is a sound field, but using just like two sources to create the full complexity of that field. But you don't get all the complex reflections, and ambisonics tries to mimic those reflections by first order, second order, third, fourth order. But when it's actually just those speakers that are there, then you don't have to do any of that wizardry of the processing. You just hear the full fidelity and the complexity of those sounds that, yeah, it just feels like a sound healing, sound bathing type of immersion that I found really quite powerful.
Yeah, I don't know how I can add to that. That's, I think the sound and the sound mix is something that really distinguishes the piece here in Venice. And its simplicity, and the simplicity of the drawings, the pencil on the paper, sort of the sort of honesty of just a recorded voice, a human voice. Yeah, it's refreshing. And I think the responses that we've had, they vary a bit, but a lot of people just, they take their headset off really slow and they just breathe and are, it's the kind of thing where you just want to be with it for a few moments. So, yeah.
It sounds like in the process of creating this piece, you had done the original recording in New York City with the three screens, and then at some point did you submit that as a like a video and a recording to the Biennale College Cinema Immersive to then get chosen to come? And what was the, at what point did you hear of the College Biennale and that might be a good next step for what you had at that point?
Yeah, this is good too. So I told you we did that 1 week workshop at the Baryshnikov Arts Center in New York. And I had contacted Amy, again in Portland, and said, hey, Amy, if you got any friends in New York that you think might be interested in this cross-disciplinary collaboration between a visual artist or, you know, a media artist and, you know, these A-list new music group, Room Full of Teeth, and this up-and-coming composer, Inti Figes Vizueta, we're going to do a thing at the Baryshnikov. And so she gave me some names, and I contacted or emailed those people. And I got an email back from Jane. Jane and Sabina were in New York. And Jane wrote and said, I have a direct conflict at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. But I said, well, do you want to meet here for coffee on Sunday? So we met at the hotel right by the park there. And she told me about the college. That was the first I heard about it. So that was in April, and then I, yeah, put together an application and then found out, I can't remember, maybe November or something. And, yeah, we went in January of 2024. So, again, it's like been 8 months or 7 months since then that the piece has come into being, yeah.
But at least at that point, you had seen some VR experiences at like PAMCUT, the College Biennale. So you got like a taste of the Venice Immersive that was brought to Portland. So you weren't coming in completely cold.
Yeah, no, not completely cold at all. It's a great opportunity that we have in Portland in terms of, I really like the take that Amy has in terms of looking at new media as well as old stuff and as well as pop stuff and making community events, the new, you know, East Side location, you know, taking it out of that, you know, central Portland old time cultural center, I think is a good thing. So yeah, lucky.
Yeah, they got a new movie theater where they're bringing a lot of like new media artists and other screenings and films. It's more of a film theater setup than like a new media space, but they do have other areas there as well. But what were some of the big, it sounds like you got connected to your sound mixer. So what were some of the other experiences of being a part of the College Biennale?
College Biennale, well, you're on this island. I don't want to say anything bad, but the food was not that great. It was one restaurant. But the people, I think you, I don't know, I guess I'll just be really honest here. You know, you get biases about, you know, who a group of people are that make VR, and if you haven't seen that much, you kind of think of, you know, certain people, you know, down their basement making VR and just living in this virtual world all the time, and, you know, say, why don't you go hiking, you know, or something. But when I got there, I mean, in order to apply, you had to have a director and a producer. So I've never had a producer. So I was like, oh. So I am in this group of women who are part of the Academy, like the Academy Awards. We get together around that. We're in the animation kind of short subject chapter, and we get around and trash films and talk about stuff. And so through that, I met Melanie Combs, who was co-producer for Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, and she also produced Marion Max, so that's two Oscars under your belt, not bad. And, you know, the studio Shadow Machine had just finished Pinocchio, and I knew they were kind of sitting idle, and so I contacted Mel, and I said, say, Mel, I've got this opportunity, this thing, and do you happen to know anyone who's like a producer that would, you know, anyway, she said, are you asking me? I said, yes, I am. And she said, okay. And I think she said, okay, thinking, oh, yeah, I'll go with you a trip to Venice on an island for 7 days. That sounds cool, you know. So we went, both of us knowing very little. I don't know if Mel had put on a headset very often at all. So we went there with pretty deep knowledge coming from cinema and film, but not of the VR world. So, I got a producer, and I still have a producer, and we're here, and we're talking to people and seeing where this thing might go. And, of course, when you have a producer, then they're interested in, like, money and butts in seat and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, I just want to make really good work. But to be able to share this kind of work. So I think the college recruited me, you know, in terms of wanting to keep fresh blood coming in, different perspectives. I think that's the way VR is going to grow, that we can expand. And like I say, I want an audience that's never put on a headset to say, wow, this is something, you know, or have this crossover with a classical new music crowd, you know, and animators, you know, is unlikely bedmates, you know, in some way that really allow us to do these kind of collaborations that enhance all of our sort of genres.
Yeah, and you had mentioned at the end of the screening that you had this dome now for this performance, but now you own this dome, and so are you taking it back to Portland, or where does it go from here?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to take it back to Portland. It's a little big for my suitcase. But, yeah, we're going to leave it here in Venice. We now have a relationship with Passe Platform, who I think they're fine musicians, composers, and, wow, they can build a dome. They're just like, everything is just like impeccable. Just real care, real dedication, and real commitment. And I think that's what we found is, like, people coming to this project, every single one of them is, like, really nice and really, really committed to this is a good work. And it's like when a work is functioning on all levels, the visuals, you know, are beautiful, the vocals are beautiful, the physical environment is, and I'm using that word beautiful, it's kind of beyond that in terms of just like something full and balanced and complex and simple. Yeah.
Great. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of this type of immersive media might be, and what it might be able to enable?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's still kind of it's a growing and an emerging thing. It's really like been emerging since like the 1990s or whatever. You'd know more than I do. You know, it keeps thinking that it's going to go and then, you know, going to go. I personally think that there's a limit to the individual headset, and that this idea of VR theater, I think the idea of the dome you know, ever since, you know, Las Vegas, the Las Vegas Dome. I mean, I'd like to do Barrio with live performance by Roomful of Teeth in Las Vegas. I mean,
in the Sphere?
In the Sphere, yeah. I mean, you know, they don't all have to be sports events or rock concerts. Like, there could be, yeah, I guess I'm just a, like, kind of, I feel like a little promoter for my little niche world of poetry and art and, yeah, experimenting with pushing boundaries instead of, you know, having a program all down pat. But to continue, I think, in my own career, just to continue to evolve. So, yeah, so I think that what the college has done by inviting, like, people like me, inviting, you know, just bringing in new voices, getting new technologies often have, like, to me, it seems like the military gets it first, or the science guys, and then you got the nerdy people, and, you know, they all lay, like, this great ground, you know, sort of foundation, and then little artists will come along saying, I don't really understand, you know, computer, you know, or whatever, but things become, you know, accessible in a way, and people start working together, you know, in terms of, I have technical skills, you know, I have a vision, I can storyboard my daydreams, you know. So continuing to welcome, the like here, this is such a great place in Venice. I mean, there's these installations, you know, so you're being allowed to not just have a headset, you know, but being allowed to experience with these, you know, whether you're walking around in a headset or you're sitting under a dome, that it becomes a kind of a lab for us to be kind of leaders and innovators. There's no question that people are going to want more immersive. Whether, you know, you can't really dystopian. It's like, oh man, the air is going to be so bad outside, we just have to be inside. I mean, that's a horrible thought. But I just think that technology is just technology. And we as humans have something to say, and that there can be a kind of profundity or profoundness that comes in a medium that maybe now is more of an entertainment and more of a novelty or more of a science or let me tell you about this issue kinds of things. So there's a lot of room to play. Yeah.
Is there anything else that's left unsaid or any final thoughts that you'd like to share with the broader immersive community?
Oh, yeah. I just want to say thanks, you guys, for welcoming me. I really do feel like the people that I met on the island, the people that I'm meeting here, just break any kind of stereotype that I had. It's exciting to be in this space where, you know, people are rooting for each other. You know, it's like, let's all do our personal best. It's almost like it feels like or something, you know. So yeah, it feels good to, like I say, be in a community. And it's like, hey, I'm the new girl, but hi.
Awesome. Yeah, well, Rose, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and share a little bit more of the process of creating Earths to Come. I think it's like a very beautiful, poetic piece with just a really amazing soundtrack that is like being bathed in a sound field of healing that, you know, really drives and evokes a lot of emotions. And just also exploring more of the abstractions of how you can move images through space in a way that is trying to get at these underlying feelings that were inspired by this poem by Emily Dickinson. So yeah, just really enjoyed the piece. And I agree that there's something around the throughput of like getting butts in seats, and you can see a VR experience. Like, yeah, you can watch it at home, but you're not going to get the same type of audio experience in that. And yes, there is the Sphere, but they need like 17,000 people to fill in. So they can't be really experimental in their like art. But there is Cosm, which is much more experimental in terms of like a much smaller scale, like 1,500 people, where they can start to experiment with more immersive creators and artists. And yeah, just seeing what types of content works for like what are people willing to come and pay for to come see. So things like the Sphere or at that scale for like big concerts or sporting events or like then having like the Cosm and then having like a geodesic dome with 12 VR headsets that, you know, you could watch a 12-minute piece, you know, get two or three of them in an hour and have, you know, 36, 40 people per hour. So yeah, just a lot of the kind of producer throughput questions that are being asked, I think part of this approach that you have in your piece starts to make sense in terms of like giving something a little bit extra than you could get at home and creating also a group cohesive experience at the end, you know, being able to watch something and share something together. So yeah, I think there's a lot of clues as to where things could go in the future that you're on the edges of unveiling for yourself, but also for the rest of the community. So yeah, just very much appreciate you coming onto the podcast and sharing all the things.
And I want to thank you, Kent, for what you're doing. It's really important that we're documenting and that you're documenting all this stuff. It's really a level of commitment that I really respect. So thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again for listening to these episodes from Venice Immersive 2024. And I am a crowdfunded independent journalist. And so if you enjoy this coverage and find it valuable, then please do consider joining my Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.